Hello and good evening. I'm Melissa Idris and you're watching The Future is Female. This is the show where we find the extraordinary in every woman. Now, June 20th is World Refugee Day, and it's a good a time as any to raise awareness about the obstacles that refugees face on a daily basis while celebrating their courage and strength in face of those obstacles, while also renewing our pledge and efforts to protect their basic human rights. That's why I'm so delighted to introduce our guest tonight. We have Dr. Siti Noraida Habibullah joining us on the show. She's the founder of Little Steps Foundation, which is a charity organization that aspires to indiscriminately help the underprivileged. She's also the founder, the recent founder of the clinic, Clinic Amal Muhajir, which is a community clinic which provides healthcare and healthcare literacy to refugees, migrants, and the asylum seeking population. So, Dr. Ida, welcome to the show. It's a pleasure to have you here.
Thank you very much, Melissa. My pleasure as well.
Dr. Ida, so, you know, when I came across your story, I knew almost immediately that I wanted to speak to you on the show. I wanted to know more about your journey because what I understand is that in your background, you know, you started out with a career in the private healthcare sector, but also then you moved on, you worked with refugees and underserved communities for many years, you know, humanitarian projects in Yemen, if I understand correctly, and a free clinic in Cambodia. I'm just wondering if you could share a little bit about that journey, how you came to work with underprivileged communities, particularly refugees and the asylum seeking population.
Well, okay, it's a long journey, but I'll try and make it short since, you know, we're on a time limit here. Okay, so yes, I'm Dr. Ida. I'm a medical doctor. I actually have an MBA because I was in a private hospital. I've been in a specialist hospital for, I think, almost 15 years as a director. And now I've actually moved to Monash University, Malaysia, as a lecturer. Mainly because I wanted the flexibility of being able to do what I'm really passionate about, you know, which is what we're talking about today. So I guess I started working as a doctor because, you know, I want to help some people. I wanted to help people. That was my main reason. But I realized over the years that the people in the hospitals are the ones who are being taken care of, you know. It's the things around them, the environment, the families, the finances that actually led to them being in the hospital, which actually requires help. You know, so that realization actually made me seek or like venture out to start looking for, like, how can I help these people? And I wasn't, you know, I didn't start off looking for refugees as the main source of people to help. I just wanted to help someone, and so I went. Yeah, so I started working around our local community, and I founded a home for girls, Hanin Firdaus, which actually focuses on the underprivileged girls who, you know, have limited access to to education, actually, you know, because they come from very socially challenging homes. And so I started a home there. And, you know, I wanted to do so many things. And one of the things I did was actually Yemen. Someone told me, I mean, we're all aware of what's going on in Yemen. But I started working with someone who was helping out Yemen in terms of giving food aid, you know, Medicare, orphans. And, you know, even United Nations have said that Yemen has got 2.3 million children who's undernourished, and they're expecting like 400,000 deaths in 2021. You know, it's not an easy thing, dying from hunger. So we had a lot of discussions with the Yemeni community to help Yemen in Yemen. But one of them voiced out that, you know, doctor, we are also struggling here. You know, we're having a lot of issues here as well. And when I asked them more, it boils down to the three usual things, which is, you know, livelihood, education, and healthcare. And since, you know, I was thinking, you know, I have this clinic in Cambodia, I've started that, it was going okay, and I have experience in healthcare management, I said, healthcare, I can do that, you know. So I said, okay, why not? So let's just start a clinic. And so we did. And when I started this clinic, I started getting exposed to all the issues surrounding refugees, you know, all the difficulties for them, the challenges for them, and everything that we hear about is just the tip of the iceberg. There's just so much more challenges that they have.
Okay, well, I'd really love to talk about those challenges better, understand what is it that, you know, what they face in terms of access to healthcare. But can I come back to your, you know, your work with underprivileged? And you talked a little bit about having your Hanin Firdaus project. I love that you set up this foundation called Little Steps, because it really resonates with me that, you know, we want to help, but we don't know how. And it's all these little steps that build to something bigger. So what was the idea to set up a foundation? What specifically did you want to help address? The ethos of this foundation on your page was, it says that to provide indiscriminate help to the underprivileged, but what were you hoping to be, you know, more specifically achieve with it?
Okay, so Little Steps is a charity organization. I mean, as opposed to a foundation. Foundation, you would require a much larger. It's a different setup altogether.
Right.
Mine is just a little steps. It's a just charity organization. The Little Steps actually to remind me, more than anyone else, that yes, we need little steps, but actually to remind me to take it slow, because I have this tendency to just go at it. So when I started Little Steps, because you know, I was just doing so many things, and then I just needed some structure to what I was doing. It was just so random. I was like, oh, you need help, I'll do that, you need help, I'll do that. But because I was working a lot based on donations and you know, sadakas, and so people who give me this, I think it's only courteous for me to give them feedbacks and you know, clear facts about what's happened. So I decided to have a structured organization to plan what I want to do, to make it more clear, and also most importantly to have a bank account, just not a personal bank account.
Right, so some form of structure to the work that you're doing, okay? Because that's also important, and you know this from your background in working in healthcare, that you know you need a process and operations and a structure for work to have effect. Let's talk a little bit about Clinic Amal Mujahir. I mean, Muhajir. So. It started out during the MCO, so it was during the past year, during the pandemic, that it really took off. Is that correct?
Yeah, actually, we it was constructed and the license was applied and we were actually ready to go. And then it was a lockdown. But because it's essential services, we actually can still continue. But because my clinic is set in a red zone, basically, it's in Serdang. So, yeah. You know, my friends who were also medical doctors, they said, I don't try and be a hero, you know, because at that time, the government was still struggling on, you know, the whole COVID issue. So we decided to hold on until things became more stable in July last year. And that's when, you know, when school started to open, then we decided, okay, we can get started with it.
Right. So why Serdang, Dr. Aida? I mean, is there a large migrant or refugee population there?
Yeah, because how it started was when I was dealing with the Yemeni community. And so I left it to them to identify a place for me, which is best for the community. And so I started there. But of course, it's not meant only for the Yemen community. But we chose Serdang because there was a large area of migrants. But mainly Yemeni at that time.
Right. Let's talk a little bit about something you touched on a bit earlier about the barriers to healthcare access. I want to better understand the challenges specific to healthcare that refugees and the asylum-seeking population face. Is healthcare so far removed from them that, you know, it becomes an impediment to their basic human rights?
Well, to be honest, our government actually has has given the refugees a 50% discount for every visit that they get, and even operations and any treatment that they get in public hospitals.
But that one is only for the UNHCR card holders.
Yes, those
right?
who are documented.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Okay.
So we're going to assume that. yes. So it's meant for the documented ones, but even for the documented patients, they are actually, you know, when you're not earning, when you're they're not allowed to work in Malaysia, right? So technically they're not earning. So even if it's 50% earning, it's still way too much for them, you know? Yeah. And the thing is, when I started the clinic in Cambodia, I never planned to start one in Malaysia, because we actually in Malaysia have one of the best health, I feel we have one of the best healthcare systems in the world, and our people actually get very good healthcare access compared to many places in the world. But this is something I needed to do because, you know, it's just basic things like hypertension, diabetes, you know, which they need to get treatment every month. You know, you need somebody with asthma, you need treatment every month. And, you know, basic things. Which are not emergencies. So this needs to be looked into, because not only does it help their community, but it also helps our public health in a way, because when we treat them, we reduce the number of complications that actually get admitted to our hospitals. So that's actually one of the advantages. And even things like TB or some infectious diseases, which we can diagnose early, all these are actually advantages to our people, as well as our public health.
And how do they know about the clinic? I mean, is it solely based on word of mouth that they spread within their own communities?
Okay, one is word of mouth and, of course, through the community. But I have this amazing group of young, social media savvy people who are like, thank God they're there. Otherwise, I'll be sitting alone in my clinic and waiting for people to come. So they actually have Instagram, we have Facebook, and they're very active and they're very passionate. I don't pay them, it's all volunteer, because the clinic is run based on volunteer basis. All my doctors, pharmacists are all volunteers. Amazing medical student committed people who comes to the clinic despite the pandemic. So these are the group that actually helps me.
That's really wonderful. I'm glad for that you have some support. But but it's also about, you know, having that trust within the community, right? It's not just enough to have awareness that there is a clinic that can provide access to healthcare for refugees and for the asylum seeking population, but it's also the need to be able to trust. Was that something that you felt like you had to build with the community first? Because, you know, you're opening up a new clinic, but whether or not you can gain the trust as a healthcare provider to that community is also another matter, right?
Yes, I think a lot of the refugees are very wary of us, because you know, many people reach out to help, but sometimes intentions they may not be clear about. In my case, it's a little different in a sense that I have been helping the Yemeni community, and they know me, and also, so the thing is, you have to reach out to the community leaders. So their trust builds because they do believe in this community leader, and he tells them, this person's okay, then I'm okay. Right. I also worked with the Somali community, for example, for a while. So, and also again with the community leaders. So I think building a rapport with the community leaders is really important for them to gain trust in you.
Yeah. And it's also important that, you know, that trust is not broken. I want to come back and talk a little bit about how we can build that trust, particularly in our public health response to the pandemic. Dr. Aida, we're going to take a quick break here on the show, but let's come back and continue this conversation. Stay tuned to The Futures Female. We'll be right back. Hi, welcome back to The Future is Female. I'm Melissa Idris and I'm speaking tonight to Dr. Siti Nuraida Habibullah, founder of Little Steps Foundation, which Little Steps charity organization, under which hosts many humanitarian projects, including Clinic Amal Muhajir, a clinic in Serdang, which solely focuses on serving the healthcare needs of refugees in that area. Now, this is to mark World Refugee Day, speaking to a woman who has dedicated her time and efforts to serving refugees and asylum and the asylum-seeking population. Dr. Ida, can I talk to you a little bit about, you know, your charitable efforts are all kind of based on the goodwill and sedekah and funds of the public and of the willing. I'm wondering what happens then if, you know, we tie healthcare of refugees and the welfare of refugee communities to charity. Is there a danger? Do you see fundraising challenges, particularly during this period of a pandemic where times are tough for many?
Yeah, actually, to be honest, yeah, my whole organization is based on charity. And funding is always a challenge. I mean, it's tiring. You feel bad having to ask friends and donors, you know, but everything has been smooth so far. And there hasn't been much challenges in terms of getting funding. In fact, I think people are much, much kinder during this pandemic. Alhamdulillah for that. I think my main challenge for funding is, you know, sustainability, right. You know, because it's an ongoing thing. We have ongoing projects. You worry about when you're going to get sick or when you're gone, like, how is this going to be sustained? So that's one of the things I would worry about. But the pandemic, honestly, has not really affected
The funding. Oh, that's good. I'm happy to hear that. You know, I'm glad that people are feeling more generous during this time. I think that really speaks to our spirit of kita jaga kita, meaning, you know, like we want to take care of, especially those we understand are struggling during this time. What about your operations in terms of your work? Has the pandemic changed the nature? Because you talked a little bit about basic healthcare and the in terms of follow-ups and non-communicable diseases, but has the pandemic impacted or shaped the way that the clinic is looking at healthcare, providing healthcare? Are you talking about vaccines and vaccine literacy and all that?
Yeah, well, so yes, the first thing is that because I'm a lecturer and all my classes are online, so I'm really happy because I have more flexibility to do all these things. But the thing is, yes, there is actually more need in, you know, in the people. I'm not even going to go into our locals who's, you know, basic things like rent, food, or the usual things. But for the clinic, our cost has actually risen because we need more PPEs. We need, you know, now patients are not able to come because of the lockdown and they're worried about being for detention. So we need to send their medications through either Lala Move or Grab or post it. So a lot of things have increased in terms of our cost. Vaccination, yes, we have been identified as one of the clinics to roll out vaccinations for the next phase when there's refugees involved. So quite excited about that.
Yes, that sounds really interesting. Can you tell me more? Because I'm curious to know. I think that NGOs and the people who are doing work on the ground are perhaps the best people to identify communities and to reach out to them. Has that been something that, you know, you're looking to do? I mean, in terms of process, how do you do that and encourage refugee communities to get vaccinated?
Well, it's been a tough time for the UNHCR actually, and also for some NGOs, which really took. I think they took a long time, months, to actually negotiate for a guarantee from the on the no arrest policy from the immigrations and the police before they actually release communication materials to refugee communities, so that they will register for COVID-19 vaccination. So it was actually a huge an effort from them. As for the communities, a lot of them are actually ready to get vaccinated. They're all waiting for it. And of course, there are some communities that requires who are not, you know, because we have different types of communities. We have the Arab communities, the Syrian, the Yemenis, and all that. And we also have the Rohingyan communities. So the Rohingyan communities, it's a little bit more difficult to reach them through the usual ways of, you know, like MySajastra and all that. We may need to actually go out there and just vaccinate everybody. I think they're all ready for it. And the government has rolled out a very clear-cut plan for every GP clinic. We all have to comply by certain rules and, you know, follow those rules before we can actually roll it out. But yes, so we are ready and waiting for our turn.
Oh, that's great. Wonderful. Because, you know, it's really important that we don't leave anyone behind as part of the vaccination rollout. And I'm glad to hear that there's been, you know, an agreement come to terms with the fact that public health is far more important than any immigration or documentation issues at the moment. That's something that we need to focus on, is the fight against this pandemic. But can we talk a little bit about that rise in xenophobia? I think it makes, you know, it makes a work for people like yourselves and your organizations and other NGOs more difficult because of this sentiment, xenophobic sentiment that's been on the rise and the increase. I'm not sure whether this is a small isolated sentiment or whether this is something that's widely held, but I would love to hear from you. Are you feeling a more negative perception coming up from the public or from certain segments of society towards those who advocate for refugees and work with them?
Well, you know, in terms of the numbers of people who are actually advocating and those who are not, I actually don't have a figure. But I feel that a lot of people are putting in a lot of work, a lot of NGOs, you know, we're trying to educate, to create awareness, I think through, you know, webinars and posts and all that, trying to educate people about the realities of refugees. And I think it's gaining some foothold because we're getting a lot of people who, I mean, more responses of people who are sympathetic towards the refugees' plight. You know, it would make life much easier if you could get our leaders as well on board and the media. You know, but a lot of Malaysians, they are sympathetic generally. But yes, there are groups of people, there are always going to be groups of people who don't agree with the refugees being here, who feel that they are here to, you know, take their livelihood.
It's almost like there's this, you know, us against them kind,
yes,
of sentiment.
Exactly. But it's funny because you know Malaysians generally, you know, we actually sympathize with the Palestinians, for example, you know, and we advocate for human rights in Palestine, but then we totally completely ignore the human right issues in our own country. So it's just we need the media, actually, to be honest with you. We need the media to spread more positive stories about the migrants. And
I completely agree. I have to say, sometimes, you know, I'm taken aback by some of the headlines that I read, and being a practicing member of the media, sometimes I'm embarrassed and ashamed when I see those headlines or even the kind of angles, you know, skewed to promote a xenophobic sentiment.
Actually, a lot of people, a lot of refugees and migrants who are actually doing amazing work, you know, they're making positive changes and they're actually contributing towards our economy and development. And I think these are the stories that need to be highlighted instead of, you know, I'm not going to go into the stories now.
I agree. Let's not amplify the bad stories. Let's talk about, you know, the contributions and the fact that we are all so much more alike than then we are different. Maybe Dr. Aida, you know, just I wanted to ask you, because of World Refugee Day, I really think it's time to take stock a little bit about that. And I was wondering, in the couple minutes that we have left, do you have a message, you know, for World Refugee Day, because of your amazing work so far? What would you like our viewers to know tonight?
Well, I think it's very important for everybody to know that the refugees are not here by choice. You know, no one's going to leave their country, a place of comfort, you know, where you know people, where you go to school. They're just normal, everyday people who had to leave their country because of, you know, the stupidity of the leaders, maybe. I don't know. I'm not going to go into that either. But they had to leave their country because of real fear of persecution, right? And so they are here not by choice. I think that's one thing we have to remember. And I hope that that every human being one day will have rights, will have respect and a place in society. I mean, whichever society that may be. And I think as a society, we need to stop listening to these loud voices that tells us that they are here to take our jobs and livelihood. You know, we need to learn more. We need to be more aware. And I just feel that we need to realize that right now, the refugee population, you know, they're not like us. They may never achieve this sense of belonging the way that we have. But isn't it possible that one day we may face the same challenges that, you know, that they are facing? Is it possible that one day we are praying that someone will give us the same break that they are asking for right now? So, I mean, you know, the saying constant in life is the only constant in life is change. Yeah, I think we need to remember that this comfort that we have right now is not forever. And they were just people like us who just needs our help right now. And I don't think we should be, you know, discriminating them in any way at all. What goes around comes around.
Yes, definitely. I mean, it could be us, you know, in the same situation. It's just, who knows, right? But thank you, Dr. Aida. It was well said, and it really resonated with me. Thank you so much for your time to talk to us and to be on the show tonight. Appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
All right, that was Dr. Noraida Habibullah speaking to us on The Future is Female. That's all we have for you on this episode. I will be back with you same time next week for another episode. Till then, good night.